thank you. So my main focus is shape, I should say. I was trained as a physicist, and I recently moved to a biology department. So I don't know that much biology, and I start, well, in my talk, I'll start to tell you a little bit about what I don't know about, and to give you at least a comparative view of what happens in world cells. And so there will be an introduction about shape of world cells, and two unrelated parts, one on fission, on the mechanics of growth of fission yeast, and the other one on organization of cell walls and the microtubules in plant cells. So for the purpose of my talk, I will use two classes of cells, non-walled cells. We have heard a lot about them, especially yesterday. They can move easily, extend protrusions, and so on and so forth. And walled cells, where the plasma membrane is surrounded by a stiff extracellular matrix, so the shape is mostly imposed by cell walls in those cells. So in cell walls, in well, you find wall cells in different, well, in different species, well, in different kingdoms, in bacteria, in most archaea, in fungi, in plants, diatoms, and in every case, the composition of the cell wall is different. Basically, a mixture of peptides and big chains of sugars. For instance, well, I won't tell you about diatoms, which are not really relevant to what to the rest of the talks, because their cell walls are made of silica, and there they the story is different from the growth of the other walled cells. So if you have questions, please interrupt. And for instance, in well, you may be more familiar with plant cells, where the extracellular matrix is a composite material made of cellulose microfibrils, which are the stiffer components linked by different components, hemicellulose, pectins, and well, this picture is about the right scale. The plasma membrane would be this thick, and the cell wall would be much thicker. So that's why I say that shape is mostly imposed by cell wall. And this would be the an electronic microscope view of the organization of cellulose microfibrils in plants. So if we look into walled cells, these are examples of archaea. We see that, well, we find that elongated, well, rod-like shapes are quite common. So I gave you as an illustration a different one, which is a square, the so-called square bacterium.
Is it a single cell or four cells?
It's divided in here, so it's it has just divided into four. Yeah, so I don't, well, they don't know the details of how it grows. So it grows in very saline media, and they managed to grow it in the lab just a couple of years ago. It's very thin, so it would be 0.2 microns in thickness. So this is a very special case, but most often you see rod-like and sometimes sphere-like. These are examples in bacteria where you have cocci, which are roundish, but very often you find elongated shapes. So, and if you look into the variety of shapes available, well, you can find in prokaryotes. You always find elongated structures. And so I'll welcome on that a little bit later. So even in fungi, except the case of Baker's yeast, they tend to be elongated. So these are fungal hyphae, or this is Fission yeast. So in all these cases, you have a stiff casing that gives the shape to the cell, and it tends to be you find that it is often elongated. So in plants also, you have specialized cells, isolated cells, which are elongated, like hair cells, or pollen tubes. So this is a growing pollen tube, so over the movies over, let's say, one less than one day. And even in, let's say on stems, the cells are quite elongated. So one might wonder why there is a wide occurrence of rod-like shapes. So one might say that there are constraints, like increasing the surface-to-volume ratio, exchange when the environment is favored by long shapes. The adhesion to the substrate is easy when you have an elongated shape than when it's a sphere. With a sphere, you stick with only one point, whereas with a rod, you stick on the line. For motile cells, the penetration into a fluid is easier if you have something rod-like. And if for non-motile organisms, in the case of plants or fungi, you can view it as a way of exploring space, so having very long cells. And another comment one might make is, at least for single-celled organisms, having slightly elongated shape make it easier to partition the genetic material between daughter cells. I mean, it's easier than if you have, it's easier to partition something long and then something roundish. So in the case, you might say that it's not that in in Baker's yeast, but in Baker's yeast, you have a necking which helps partition in genetic material.
But brown cells do it quite accurately.
Well, but they change shape. Well, in animals, you mean, or mammalian cells?
Yeah.
They change shape, so that's what we've seen in the previous days. They have a constriction at the time, while they separate genetic material. So I don't pretend that this is relevant. That's only that's one might think. I don't there is no to prove that this is something which has evolved such that to make it easy to separate the material, you would need experiments to show that. So, and there is no evidence, no real evidence for that. It just happens that there are many, most encased cells are rod-like. Any other question?
It's certainly true that in fission yeast, if you get rid of the cell wall, so that it encases and becomes sphere.
Yeah.
Then the cortical ring doesn't stabilize.
Yeah, that's true. But then you might argue that it's synthesized enough proteins to do the septation when it's rod-like. So when it becomes roundish, you need more such proteins. So there's not enough. There are not enough to help the division.
You've given all these arguments. You can tell us which one is correct.
No. So that was just to put my talk into a more general frame. So I don't pretend to answer these questions, and I will not answer. So if you have a stiff case, and if you want, so the one question is, first question is how to grow. So you need to inflate the case, to inflate the casing, and to add materials to the casing. That's one thing. So you need a higher, a high enough osmotic pressure inside the cell to be able to deform cell walls. So that's Turgor pressure. And if you want to grow into a rod-like shape, you must do something more. So if, for instance, you take a rubber balloon and you inflate it, you'll find that the balloon, so I added the blue circle myself on the picture, the balloon is almost round. So if you want to make it into something rod-like, there are two possibilities. Either add hoops to strengthen the balloon in that direction, so to add hoops like that so that it inflates in one direction. Actually, there are some rubber balloons which are designed this way. Or you can soften one part of the balloon and, the tip, and let it grow. So the two cases would be that of diffuse growth, where with reinforcement of the balloon in the circumferential direction, or tip, the so-called tip growth, where you soften the balloon at the tip. And these are two strategies which you find in bacteria, archaea, plants, and fungi. And so plants would be in that case or in that case. Fungi mostly in that case of tip growth. So you'll hear more about that with Otter tomorrow and Paul Nurse afterwards. And so in the following, I'll tell you about two questions related to fission yeast and to plant cells. In fission yeast, we asked the question of what are the forces involved in growth? So can one measure these forces, characterize the properties of cell walls in an easy way, and use them to characterize mutants in growth or osmotic pressure regulation. And in plant cells, what controls the orientation of cellulose microfibrils, which reinforce the walls in a given direction. So first, fission yeast. Fission yeast grows mostly at the poles, or at one or two poles, and materials are brought to the poles along microtubules, and they help softening and increasing the mass of the wall at the tip. It's a model system for cell polarity, and we tried to find a way, a simple way, to measure forces involved in growth, which is to use a PDMS template with holes in it. So this is a top. This would be a top view. You have cylindrical holes in it, and you take a cover slip, you push the cells in the holes, And you let the, you can let then the cells, observe the cells growing into the into the chambers. So by making the PDMS softer or stiffer, you can control the forces applied, well, or the order of magnitude of forces applied on the cells. And by varying the size of the holes, you can start constraining the cells earlier or later. So you had, you would have something like that, with a cell growing growing into the hole. The cell deforms the side of the hole. So from the from the displacement or the deformation of the chamber, you can deduce the or have an estimate of the forces applied on the cell.
Does it actually buckle?
A little bit. So you'll see buckling in this one. So if the forces are large enough, so you see what you would expect. So I won't do it with a stick, otherwise I would break it. What you would expect if you push longitudinally this this stick, so it would curve sideways. And to show you that the cells are still happy, if they divide while they're in the hole, for instance, the two daughter cells recover a straight shape. So, and you can take, you can also take the cells out of the holes and put them back, and they switch from straight to curved shapes. So which?
So in order to measure the forces produced by the cell, you must adjust the elasticity of these holes to sort of be of the same order of magnitude as the one of the cells, right? I mean, with that cell that is doing the buckling, you could not really measure anything then.
Exactly. So you can have both, all situations. So if it's very stiff, if the chamber is very stiff, the cell would buckle immediately. If the chamber is very smooth, the cell will remain straight, and you can measure the forces exerted by growth. But if it buckles, you can have another information on the cell, which is its bending stiffness. So you can measure the properties of the cell walls roughly. So you can it's a way to do both with the more or less the same system. So that's a series of pictures to show that according to the stiffness of the chamber, if the chambers are very stiff, the cells are buckle quite immediately. If the chambers are moderately stiff, the chambers are deformed a little bit, and the cells can buckle. And if the chambers are soft enough, the cells remain straight. And so we can, using the deformation of the chamber, we can have an estimate of the force applied during growth. So it would be proportional to the elastic modulus of PDMS, which is which is controlled, and the radius of the cells, so they are considered as cylinders, and the deformation of the chamber. So like pictured like this, so a chamber of diameter d is deformed into something of diameter d plus small d. So that's one thing. So that gives the estimate of forces applied on the cell. And the other information comes from the buckling of the cells. So when at the point where they buckle, like this one, you can have an estimate of the forces applied on them through the behavior of the chamber. And if they buckle, you have a relation between the force applied on the cell tips and the elastic modulus of the cell walls, a geometric property the cell wall. So that would involve the thickness of the walls, the radius of the sheaths of the cells, and the length of the cells. So all properties that you can measure. And well, you can try, well, when you measure the data on a large number of cells, there's quite a scatter. But well, roughly, the beginning of this curve gives an estimate of the cell wall modulus. Any question? Yeah?
The cell wall. Do you know something about what the cell wall is?
In fungi, it's chitin. So it's, if I'm not wrong, a polymer of amino acids and sugars. And it's, according to electron microscope data, it's not very well, it's not organized. So it's something rather isotropic.
So that curve you showed was a parabola from the last part?
Yeah. So the, the slope at this slope here would be, would correspond to this low, and the fact that it is a parabola is we ascribe it to the nonlinear behavior of the chambers. When they highly deformed, there's no more linear relationship between force and displacement.
As species get older, I think the cell wall gets bigger.
So we haven't seen a systematic trend in this data. So I would say that old cells would be either up or down the curve. So at this resolution, we don't, at the precision of the measurements, we don't really make the difference between old and young cells. So.
Do you think the scatter is real?
I don't know. No, I don't. Well, it's difficult to say because, as you see, the chambers are not perfect. Measuring the displacements is somehow, it's sometimes tricky. So it's difficult to say. So I would tell you that, the measure is not that precise. So, it's about 30% precision. So, and we find the modulus for the cell walls, which is in this range, around 100 megapascals. And so which is, so this is using the Buckling threshold, and which is of the same order of magnitude as things measured for other fungi, and slightly lower than for plants, and higher than for bacteria. So, but if you have noticed, there is a high difference between data obtained on fission yeast, which suggests that this kind of measurements is not that that is budding yeast. What did I say? I meant budding yeast. Yeah.
If the chamber was small enough that some of the cell couldn't get
to twice
its size, couldn't divide, what?
So it would. So if the chamber is, so either you get. So we haven't kept cells. I think they start. They don't divide well if they don't have enough room. Yeah. Then, so that's one point, measuring the properties of the cell walls. And the other point is having a force, a growth constitutive property, which is a force velocity relation. So if you consider it as an elastic shells with inner pressure P, a radius r, thickness of the wall h. You can estimate the tension in the cell, well, the longitude, well, the tension, let's say, in the going part, which is this one, as proportional to the pressure, to the radius, and divided by the thickness. And if you look at the growth velocity, so the derivative with respect to time of the length of the cell, and you think, well, you take the simplest model for that, that is something visco, which behaves viscoplastically with respect to growth. So the velocity is, you assume that it is proportional to the tension in the wall. You get a relation between the velocity and, well, and the tension in the wall, or, and which you can correct in the case where there is an external force applied on the cells, and would give a velocity as a function of force, something like the velocity, well, the free growth velocity when there is no external force, and so the the pressure over the equilibrium, well, the standard pressure. So in this, if pressure is not regulated, this would be one. And so it would be 1 minus the force over a stalling force. So this would give the velocity as a function of force as a constant times 1 times 1 minus, so I should write it here. So let me see. So if we look at cells growing in a chamber, so that would be the change in length or the increase in length of the cell. Before they reach the edge of the chamber, they grow rather, well, roughly linearly with time, and the growth velocity decreases when they touch the walls. And so we can, interpreting the data, we get a velocity as a function of the applied force, and which would be the blue points here, and as if you approximated by a line and you extrapolated, that would give a stalling force in the order of a few micro, well, tens of micronewtons, and from this stalling force you can have an order of magnitude of the osmotic pressure in the cells, because it's the maximum, well, the stalling force at most is the pressure inside the cell multiplied by the cross section of a cell. So and this would give an order of magnitude of about 1 megapascal for the osmotic pressure. Questions?
That's what the other measurement was for cutting these. Were they measuring the osmotic pressure?
Yeah, well, it's a... Yeah, most likely.
So doesn't this assume that the only source of motion, the internal source of motion, is the osmotic pressure?
Right. Yeah. So, in fact, you can... well, you can wonder whether the cytoskeleton is involved. And you can estimate... So there are 4 bundles of microtubules in fission yeast. You can estimate the forces, so and it's way too small.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's sure. But you can imagine that the chemistry itself.
Yeah,
well. The source of matter.
Oh, there is a source.
Yeah, well, but you need, otherwise, it would get thinner and thinner.
But this is assuming this sort of matter has no mechanical effect by itself.
Yeah.
Which
it assumes that I think the source of matter is well, is comes slow, very slowly with respect to I don't know, to another time scale.
can you
you actually measure how much of the stuff that's being directed to the membrane is being synthesized? Growth rates?
I don't know if there are such measures, I don't think. Do you know, Jane?
People have measured the synthesis, how much the cell is synthesizing after the cell wall material in the Golgi, but no one has ever measured the secretion in the world. Apparently, it's very complicated.
So you can have an estimate indirectly, but that doesn't give you any more information. You look at the growth velocity, you know that the thickness is roughly constant during growth.
Right, that's the amount that's being incorporated. I'm just wondering if there's a defect in the synthesis rate when you...
So you could imagine that there's feedback because there are mechanosensors in the cell membranes. So you could imagine that there is a feedback on cell growth, and at some point we found such a feedback in our data, but it's not clear at this point. So the data is not precise enough to be sure that there is such a feedback. For
it? Is it not just the synthesis of cell wall material, but just any protein synthesis? So is there any sort of reporter of the rate of growth goes down by a factor of two, right? So you think that that's a considerable effect,
Yeah.
The number of ribosomes change. Well, no, I suppose they're stable now. There must be some marker of sort of biosynthetic.
Let me think. So,
there's been a paper like doing these experiments and combining them with metabolic rate production.
But do you know? So, what would be
people have measured metabolic rates? Yeah.
So what's a good way of measuring it?
I don't know how to do that. I really don't know.
I know it has to be done. I know it's physical. I know it's not in the bucket. Right?
I know it's physical and probably normal, but I don't know.
So my
bacteria is definitely ribosome numbers.
My feeling in that case is that, I might be wrong, is that the synthesis rate is not changed that much, and it's just that the walls thicken or something like that. But we haven't been able to observe any correlation.
You're crowding, you're stopping the growth basically. The cell is producing at the same rate. You're just crowding inside your leg because it's not, if it's only one cell wall, if it was only cell wall, yeah, you're thickening the cell wall and that's it. But if you're in all the other production, you're just crowding and crowding even more.
But then, that's a general question. What controls the rate of protein production in a cell? Is there a volume sensing mechanism? So, yeah, it's not. It's more general than in this setup.
But these are very unnatural conditions. It's interesting to see. Or is it unnatural? So, what are the pressures when these things are growing? When they're free, but there's a big colony and they're pushing against one another.
Well, it's unnatural for fish and yeast, but it would be natural for parasitic fungi, which have to push through plant cell walls.
Well, the canonical model for yeast is that growth is independent of the cell division, the cell cycle, and so on. So this is sort of the same thing. I guess one might guess that what's happening is that you're slowing down the growth. You constrain the growth, and so then you generate very suboptimal concentrations of all kinds of things that continue to get made until you can't expand. And then you go slower.
Well, it's a question. I don't know.
There's one example in budding yeast where there's a requirement for cyclopentin kinase activity to maintain polarity when you bud. Mm-hmm. So now with these CDK inhibitors, you can very acutely stop cyclopentin kinase activity. And what happens is that you stop all of the secretory pathway that's sort of directing a bunch of things to the butt to allow the butt to expand. And so then you do kind of what you're doing but in a different way. You kind of just fix the cell wall. However, the protein synthesis continues for an hour or something until
the cell is just protein dependent.
But well, in this case, they seem to be still very happy. Well, if you take them out of the chambers, or if when they buckle.
Well, they're growing as well, so they're not super happy.
Now we're trying to, well, it's work in progress, we're trying to use the setup to characterize mutants for instance, turgor regulation. So because you're applying external forces, so you change the effect of turgor, or also cell divisions. So now I'll step to the second part, which is related to plant cells and the organization of the reinforcement of cell walls in plants. So in plants, as I told you earlier, the walls are rather quite organized with cellulose microfibrils, which are generally parallel to the long axis of, perpendicular to the long axis of the cell. So the general belief is that, or was that, the cells grows in the, that the cellulose microfibrils are surrounding the cells in the direction perpendicular to its growth axis. So the question we asked was, what controls the orientation of cellulose microfibrils, and how they impact on growth? So this was known indirectly, but was shown very recently, that in fact cellulose synthesis is guided by cortical microtubules in plant cells. So if you look at marked cellulose synthase and at microtubules, in general, you find that the cellulose synthase complex is roughly colocalized with microtubules, and if you look at this dynamically, you find that cellulose synthase complex tends to travel parallel to microtubules. So then the question of knowing what controls the orientation of cellulose microfibrils is what controls the direction of cortical microtubules in plant cells. Just one thing to make it clear. Yeah?
So growth of the cell walls doesn't realign? Yeah. I mean, I would
think there is a change in orientation. That's true. But as the wall is renewed continuously, there is a reorientation as you go from the inside to the outside of the cell. So inside is quite perpendicular to the long axis, and outside is slightly inclined. But on average, it's rather parallel to that direction, except in very old, very differentiated cells.
So you're saying that the time scale for renewal of the cell is so practical that you mimic the polarization of the cell that's mimicking the polarization of the cell at the time?
Well, at least the synthesis follows the microtubules, and the general trend is rather parallel to the cytoskeleton. So one thing to just to make it clear, in plant, well, because we've been hearing a lot about animal cells, in plant cells, I would say that the role of the actin cortex is more roughly played by the cortical microtubules cortex. So in interface cells, you have, so if the cell was like that, you would have microtubules throughout, well, paving all the cell plasma membrane, and were nucleated almost anywhere near the plasma membrane, and that they would cover most of the cell plasma membrane. So then a first thing that one can do to see what happens to microtubules in plant cells.
Oreski, are we just looking at, in these images, are you just looking at one surface?
It's one surface, sorry, yeah. These images correspond to one surface. It's confocal microscopy with a confocal planes corresponding to the to one of the surfaces of the cells. So these are epidermal.
So like in your picture, I should think of this as a two-dimensional surface, basically.
And so you should think that, so you have one cell surface here, and this continues like that. So we tried to investigate that in the shoot apical meristem, which is the tip of plant stems, and to see what happens there when we affect or play with microtubules, and I think it's the best, one of the best systems to do that, because the cells are indifferentiated, continuously dividing, and so on. So this would be a picture of the tip where the plasma membrane is marked in red. So we have added, there's a drug which prevents the appearance of new organs. In a normal plant, you would have all sorts of bumps surrounding, corresponding to the flowers or to the baby leaves. So first thing, if you depolymerize microtubules, you find that the tip grows into something round, almost spherical, which suggests that without microtubules, growth is isotropic. When we check that in more details by looking at the organization of the cell walls or the geometry of the cell walls in that case. So without microtubules, growth is becomes roughly isotropic. Now, if we look at the tip with microtubules, so plasma membrane would be marked in red here, and the green would be marked microtubules. So so the tip of the stem, so this is a top view, the tip of the stem would be somewhere here. Here and there you would have bumps corresponding to flower primordia. So a side view would be something like that, with a bump here and another bump there. So the center would be here, and so this would be the crease separating a primordium from the tip of the plant. So first thing, when you look at the tip of the stem, we find that on time courses, the orientation of microtubules is very dynamic. Whereas on the flanks of the tip of here, you find that, I don't know if you can see it well, but microtubules are roughly oriented circumferentially. Whereas here at the crease, they're oriented in this direction. And at the tip of primordia, they would be quite dynamic 2. So if we make, well, we simplify this structure mechanically by saying that it's a shell with the walls of the, well, with the shell corresponding to the epidermis of the plant stem, and which a shell which is inflated by turgor pressure. This is what you what one can compute about the stress pattern or the forces in the shell. So one would find that forces at the tip are isotropic, so there is the same force in this direction than in this direction. On on the flanks, forces would be larger in the circumferential direction, twice as large as in the longitudinal direction, and in the crease between the primordium and the central zone, forces would be extensional in this direction, so in this direction, and slightly compressive in this direction. So if one correlates this with microtubules direction, which is that they're dynamic at the tip, well oriented in the crease and in the flanks, one finds that there is the microtubules seem to be aligned with the direction of larger force. So to check whether it's true, which region? That's if it's a cylinder, it's half, but the shape is not exactly a cylinder, so it's rather with a parabola.
If we come back to the orientation pattern, is it pneumatic like or polar pneumatic like?
It's this is a rather large scale view, so we can't say which is which, but in fact, so if you what is known is that the microtubule associated proteins do not discriminate, well, or many of them do not discriminate between microtubules in one direction or not, so it's rather it is pneumatic. I think it is pneumatic, so in the bundles you have microtubules in both directions, and in high resolution images you can see microtubules polymerizing in one or in the other.
And so in the body is really isotropic, or could you identify a discrimination pattern or sort of stuff like that?
Yes, they would be. When I say isotropic, it's a time, when you average over time, at a given time, the directions are more or less well defined, but they rotate over a few hours.
Is discrimination
pattern then? It's only now that we have a tool to analyze, to measure really the pneumatic order parameter. So we can do it now, but we haven't done it yet.
So you actually didn't finish the sentence. So how fast did they rotate?
A few hours. Sorry, it's the time. Well, it's the time scale for bundling of microtubules. It's a few hours. Let's say 2 or 3 hours. And time divisions is 1 day. So after cytokinesis, an order is recovered in a few hours. Any other questions?
And the cell division there is unoriented.
At the tip, it is unoriented, and well, elsewhere it is oriented, and it tends to follow the same the stress patterns as well. It tends to be cell division plates tend to be parallel to interface microtubules. So to check whether this is this correlation is correct, you have to manipulate mechanically the plants. So one way to do it is to compress the tip. So this would be if the tip was that. So to do this and. So the effect is not it's not huge, but on if you do statistic, you find that it tends to align microtubules. So if you press this way, it tends to align microtubules in this direction. So which could correspond to the higher stress direction, and if you ablate cells we're using a laser ablation, you would expect that the stress pattern would be would go around the hole, that the forces would be larger in this direction, and after this would be the initial meristem ablation, and a few hours later microtubules are oriented around the hole. Does this mechanism give? Imagine, so we get back to the balloon, that there is some, that it grows a little bit, that there is a small bump. So if you look at the stress pattern in the bump, you would expect it to have higher stress in that direction. So you would expect microtubules to align here in that direction, to orient cellulose deposition in that direction. So you're building somehow a hoop around the bump, which constrains it to grow upwards. So on and so forth. So this mechanism for the orientation of microtubules is a way to stabilize growth in one direction. But it doesn't tell you where more growth will occur. So, and this would apply either to the stems considered as a whole or to isolated cells. So, and actually you can, this was done by Pavel Kropinski and Heinrich Johnson. If you put this hole in this rule of microtubule reorientation and stiffening of the walls into a more quantitative model, it indeed gives elongated shapes.
But you never see that actually in deep growing cells.
You don't have only tip grown. In algae, growth is diffuse, and the microtubules are oriented perpendicular to the long axis. So in tip grow, it doesn't apply to tip growing cells, obviously, because you're just softening the tip. So and you'll tell us more about it. It applies to algae. So whenever it applies to cells which grow diffusively.
Right.
So diffusively, tip growth. So to make it clear, tip growth is when growth occurs only at the tip, and diffuse growth is when growth occurs all along the organ or the cell. So, in what I have told you, one finds two strategies for anisotropic growth. So, the first one was growing by at the tip and softening the tip, and using microchambers, we were able to measure the forces involved, and we hope to use that more into to answer more biological questions. And in the case of diffuse growth, the deposition, in plants and algae, the microtubules are orient along the high stress direction, which stabilizes growth in one axis. So in fact, I told you about what happens at the cell level. I'm more interested in plant development and in how one goes from the cellular level to global shapes, so to morphogenesis. And before finishing, so the people involved in that study. So for Fission East, it was a collaboration with Nicola Mank and Fred Chang from Columbia University. And for plant cells, it was with Francis Corson, Yves Couder and Stefan Vaughan on the physical side, and Olivier Amand and Yann Trasse from my new colleagues in Lyon on the biology side, Alec Meyerowitz and Marcus Heisler just nearby on the biology side also, and numerical collaboration with Pavel Kuklinski and Henrik Johnson. So thank you for your attention.
We hadn't heard of cortical microtubules. I hadn't heard of cortical microtubules until just now. Can you say, so that's a fraction of all the microtubules that are present close to the surface of this?
In interface, almost all microtubules are near the surface of the cell.
And they're bundled like this, but they still mediate transport.
It's more, a little bit, but actually it's more actin involved than microtubules in plant cells.
More actually,
no, there are actually the motors. I did see the movie by Bishara Kashar. Did you see it? I forgot in which country it is. But the motor speeding just like mad. I don't know what they are doing.
That's cytoplasmic. So in algae, when the some cells become very large, are polyploid, so you need something to mix the materials. So you have cytoplasmic streaming, and in that case you have motors going along actin.
No, but the one actually ride on the microtubules.
Ah, okay,
and
then.
And they're just, I mean, they run just like mad. They're just amazingly fast.
But it's in plants.
Yeah. In algae. Well, definitely,
I mean,
it's the same.
No,
was it in algae or?
I'm old. I just don't remember. It was some kind of vegetable.
No, the reason I'm bringing it up is, and I haven't consolidated it. We've heard that actin and microtubules keep switching places. You know, in mammals, the mitochondria move along microtubules, and yeast, they move along actin, and then plants, we haven't heard much of what's going on. But I imagine that these things are serving structural purpose, but also somebody has to be moving things to the right place in order to get growth to work.
Yeah, so it's actin, well, for growth, it's actin driven.
What is actin driven?
So the transport of vesicles. Of vesicles from the Golgi to or other endocompartments to the wolf.
What about the transport of the ER and of the Golgi and of mitochondria?
This I'm not sure. So I think it's mostly on actin, but I would have to check. Actin. So is rather, in strands going from the nucleus to the periphery of the cell, mostly. So, and in some regions, so when where there are no microtubules, it's organized in a cortex-like structure. So, for instance, in tip growth, it's organized in a cortex-like structure at the tip.
Coming back to your question, actually, in fungi, actually, transport is mediated by microtubules, in plants, mediated by actin, and in other kind of produce and other organisms, it changes. So, you, different organisms transport material in different ways,
but
using different sort of stuff.
In yeast, at least,
it's my.
It says that mitochondria move along the actin.
I'm saying in deep growth, the growth actually, the material that is transported over like the growing region, it is. I'm not saying in pigeon yeast, but pigeon yeast it is, but in case of like fungal hybrid, for instance, it is microtubules.
No, this is the kind of what I'm getting at. So somehow is there a correlation between the growth strategy and you have to create lipids at the right place at the right time at all. So that might be part of the explanation for why you would choose a different cytoskeletal element.
I think that the goal is here, you have to grow the cell wall in a place. I mean, you have to transport things there, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you do with microtubules, you do with
acting, you don't care. So my feeling would be that there is, with that respect, there is not such a big difference between actin and microtubules. Huh? So that when one system is not used, the other one is used instead, and conversely. So, but
bring the nucleators of microtubules along the tube.
The nucleator of microtubules are embedded in the plasma membrane. So you need to bring them somehow, but it's the same. It's the same as producing plasma membrane or any other plasma membrane localized proteins.
So you said you think it's this, they're interchangeable somehow, microtubules and actin, but so far. Aqueous, I haven't seen a single talk where somebody has addressed both the actin and the microtubules in the same system. It always looks one or the other.
It depends on which fluorescent proteins you have.
I don't think they're completely interchangeable because for some things, like for nucleus positioning in yeast, this relies on the ability to have catastrophic in this kind of thing, which actin does not do.
Cell division in plants relies mostly on actin. It relies on actin strands. The nucleus is positioned by actin strands, which go from the nucleus to the cell plasma membrane. I think pulling, but.
Could it be just the evolutionary choice? Either you choose one or the other, and then it gives you.
But they still have very different physical properties, so maybe for something.
Oh, but that makes a difference between dense and dense.
But so
it's a superficial answer.
No, once you do for actin, once you make actin cables or stress fibers, they become very, by pulling, they become highly oriented. So it increases their effective stiffness. So.
That's a good point, actually, because all the actin cables that are used in growth of plant cells and all this, they are actually not applying forces. They are just the transport and not the applying forces. Not huge forces, they're not pushing on anything, they're not like really.
Isn't there this? There's one case, I don't know the difference, okay, some sperm which is based on an actin bundle pushing, which has been used in vitro, primarily sperm.
A sperm we're using the...
Yeah, but that is a different. You have huge bundles and you compress it like a spring. Yeah. You have to store all the energy first elastically.
Well, but it's rather, it's spring-like.
But even if this is true, you sort of arbitrarily choose one set or the other. To start off, there must be, once you've made a decision, various other things must be correlated. What do you do with your mitochondria, your ER, your Golgi, your first generation? All these might have a... you can't pick all possible combinations.
Well, it seems unlikely that some bug just decided the next day to switch everything. It has to be in the state. So that's the more interesting question.
Actually, what we believe were early reason why the microtubule system a few years ago now, people realized that the active mining system is also a player.
So if you look at some of the strange organisms, there should be some system that uses both for the same purpose.
But also it seems that, I mean, if I talk to some of my biology friends, they say that some of the myosin, not myosin too, but some of the myosins seem to have a damping role. I mean, they just slow down things, which is kind of unexpected, but they anchor on momentarily the active cytoskeleton thing, which otherwise are moved around by the microtubule system. They contribute to everything that is sensory at the same time.
You should actually look at those diagrams.
Well, for acting, my colleagues plan to do that, but currently they don't have a line with the labels, with stable labeled actin. Well, for some reason. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe there are people who know, but.
Yeah, there are diatoms that grow in filaments. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they added the
thing. Well, in diatoms, the question is is how they direct silica to be, or carbonates to the right position. So that's a question too.
What are the microtubules? Are they in some sense random bundles, or are they more like these cilia template?
No, they're random. They self-organize. I mean, if you look at the evolution of the orientation, it starts roughly random, and by polymerization, catastrophes, and association with proteins, they tend to bundle over time. And so according to mutants, you have more, they're less or more bundled, less or more oriented. Not by treadmilling. So they are nucleated. There are gamma tubulin nucleators, and they grow by polymerization by the other end. Sorry? It's difficult to say because it's not that. Organized. I would say rather so than vortices, at least in a given cell, that it's rather domains with different orientation that you find, and that tend to coarsen over time.
Room at 11.